We're at the beautiful Drury Lane South, talking with the star of the comedy show here, Miss Mercedes McCambridge. You're a Chicago gal, aren't you?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You were born here?
No, I was born in Joliet, but I grew up here, and all of my schooling was here through college, and it was the first place I earned an honest dollar, and it's home.
You went to Mundelein College?
Yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. I was on scholarship there for drama. And when I was a sophomore, I was in a play, and some people from NBC saw it and came backstage afterwards. And as a result of that, I signed a 5-year contract with NBC, and that was the beginning.
And that was your first professional job, and you got a 5-year contract
mm-hmm.
with NBC?
Mm-hmm.
And were you on the staff here in Chicago then?
I don't know what you mean, staff.
Were you a staff actress? Were you working?
I was an NBC actress. They had contract actresses in those days, and actors. A great many people were. It was the hub of all of radio drama and soap opera, and the great comedies all came out of here too. Then, Amos and Andy and Fibber McGee and Molly, and a great many others. Vic and Sade, which was my favorite, but all of the soap operas and Lights Out. Good heavens, we First Nighter. So many, many were there.
Can you recall what your first radio job was? Your first role on a show?
I can't really. Some people say it was a poetry reading on the Chicago Symphonic Hour with the Mundelein First Speaking Choir, which was signed to a year's contract at NBC. And other people tell me, no, it was on a show called Pretty Kitty Kelly. I think it was on Guiding Light. But I don't know. Those are the dim, dark ages.
You were Rose on Abie's Irish Rose.
Oh, yes, but that was out of
later,
New York.
Later than
mm-hmm.
that.
That was later. Uh-huh. I played Rosemary on that. But that was in New York, after my contract here had expired.
Mm-hmm.
So that was when I was an old-timer in radio. 5 years
Did
later.
You work exclusively for NBC here after the 5 years? Then
no,
you
no.
went to New York?
After the 5 years, I went to New York. Uh-huh. You see, I signed the contract when I was 17, a sophomore in school, so I had to continue in school until I graduated, and then that left about 2 years left on the contract, and then I went in to conquer New York.
Mm-hmm. And I think you did, too.
Well, everybody thinks that New York is conquerable, but... It proves to be a very formidable foe, or friend, depending.
You terrorized a great many radio listeners over the years in your career as a lady who would scream at the drop of a hat, or whimper, or frighten the listener. Why did it seem that you always got involved in those kinds of
radio
roles?
I didn't. That's a gross misrepresentation. I was Big Sister.
Ruth Wayne.
You're darn right. I played all of the good girls, too. But people don't remember the good things in performances, even. People remember the... It's interesting for me now, and in almost every city, somebody will come up to me and say, oh, I remember I Love a Mystery.
Mm-hmm.
And the show that they remember most on I Love a Mystery was a sequence we did about bats in South America in a gigantic cave. And these people in places like Atlanta and St. Louis and Denver will stand on the street corner and they will depict the bats. Their arms will go up and they will get a wild look in their eyes and they will tell me all about these gigantic bats in the cave. I don't have the heart to say, listen, it was four actors standing around a microphone on Sunset Boulevard. That's all it was. But these are the things people remember.
Those were important days, though, those I Love a Mystery days. That was Temple of Vampires, and that was
You remember it, too?
Tony Randall.
No, that was before Tony.
It was in the first
run
of it?
Yeah, Jack, Doc, and Reggie, when Mike Raffetto.
Oh.
And,
well, you were in the second run of it then
later,
weren't you?
Yeah. Well, Carlton Morris was one of my mentors. I've really been extremely fortunate with Orson and Carlton Morris and Arch Obler, and just today on the phone... Hi Brown, who does the CBS Mystery Playhouse now, and did Inner Sanctum, and did indeed do Big Sister. I do a lot of the CBS Mystery Playhouse.
Oh, well, we know. We hear you.
But also, I don't know whether it's publicized yet or not, but Hi has sold a new show on radio, a big thing. And we're all delighted because Radio is still the best, you know, of all branches, radio is the best. It's the most imaginative and the most participatory. It's the most involving. And I prefer it to all the others.
As an actress who has worked on the stage and on the screen and in radio, you act visibly before the camera or before the audience on the stage or on the screen. But when you're on radio, for the most part, you work probably without an audience in the studio.
Yes, yes.
And there you stood with your script.
That's right.
Was it easier for you to do that? To emote, so to speak?
No, I don't think so. On stage, there are a great many things to consider. In films and in television, there are a great many things to consider. But in radio, it has its own particular discipline, its own particular set of rules and principles. And I think they are as rigorous as any of the others, at least as rigorous. There is only one sense that you can use in order to communicate. And you have to call up all kinds of things in your own bag of tricks or experience in order to make it felt. As an example, a thing that I did, The Demon in The Exorcist, the film, is a 100% radio performance because you never see me. All you do is hear me. And yet, through the vocal apparatus, I made people throw up and pass out and faint and all that silly stuff. I keep insisting they brought that from home. Uh-huh. I think they came with their neuroses, paid their $3 and threw up or did whatever they were going to do. But it was interesting to pull it off in a film because it was really radio. And it's, I've done this before on a microphone since the film, but I wondered how I could convey through sound an impression of the demon breathing. In the book, Bill Blatty describes very colorfully the horror of the sound that the two exorcists feel when they are outside the closed door of the room and they are still aware of the breathing going on inside of the demon, inside the little girl. Well, how are you going to make that sound? Well, I finally came up with something that worked, and it's what's on the soundtrack. When I was little, I had bronchitis. I've had it all my life. And I wheezed, and do wheeze when I get into attack of it. So really what you hear with the demon, let me do it for you now. When the demon breathes, this is what you hear. All it is bronchitis. Well, that wouldn't mean anything in front of a camera or out there on that stage. Mm-hmm. But in radio, you can do so many things, so many, many things. If you risk the amount of imagination you have and trust the amount of imagination of the listener.
Were you able to create the pictures that you were requested to create on radio with a minimum amount of direction from a man behind the glass booth?
Well,
did you develop much of this yourself?
There were great directors in radio, and there were a lot of mediocre ones, and there were some absolutely useless ones. That's true in any branch of our profession. I worked with the greatest ones, and sometimes with the worst ones. But a director who has a keen ear is a very rare bird, and any actor who doesn't adhere to his desires, he's the boss after all, you're there to do his bidding, is a little silly. Any actor who defies that, go along with what the man is hearing in the control room. He is hearing it, you're only projecting it, and maybe what you think is effective loses all of its effectiveness in the distance between the microphone and the control room. So you listen to the boss, and you do what he wants you to do.
Well, you were a part of the Mercury Theater on the air?
At the very end, I worked with Orson on a lot of radio programs, and I'm devoted to him. His child is my godchild, and I think Orson is probably one of the three or four great influences in my life.
You said you worked with Arch Obler.
Yeah.
On the Lights Out series.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was a regular job for you, wasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Almost?
Yes, uh-huh. Many of these things uh-huh. were. Inner Sanctum uh-huh. was... Hebron laughs at the story that I used to depend on Inner Sanctum in New York to pay my rent. And one day I called my exchange for my call on Inner Sanctum, and the lady at the exchange said, you didn't get a call. And I was ready to fire the exchange for their inadequacies. And she said, the calls are out, but there's no call for you. So I called High Brown, and I said, what is this about no call this week? And he said, no, I'm sorry, there aren't any women. And I said, there's no excuse. I got to pay my rent. You know, where's the call? And he said, can you play an elevator man? And I said, sure, you bet I can. You bet. And I did and paid my rent. And, yeah, you would depend on these things. And sometimes you'd get so confused with the shows on your schedule that it would run it terribly close. You'd get elevators waiting for you. Buzz Meredith used to hire an ambulance uh-huh. to get from NBC to CBS in New York. It was two blocks. But if you got stuck on Fifth Avenue, you'd be dead. So
Well, you'd have shows back to back.
Oh, yeah, many, many uh-huh. times. But there was something about the radio group. Well, the time was different, of course. But I think the people involved in radio, the performers I'm talking about now, see, nobody had to get their noses fixed, and nobody had to worry about weight, and there wasn't the terrible competition about who was more attractive. A man who physically was not what you would call Clark Gable, Everett Sloan, God rest his soul, was the most romantic actor on radio. In a truly classical sense, he was absolutely the most appealing, masculine, macho, handsome, beguiling person. Well, that couldn't happen in any of the visual branches of the media.
But that was the magic of radio.
You bet. Yeah. It's the best. It truly is the best. And the kids now, do you know that with a High Brown show, the CBS Mystery Playhouse, that in the first 3 weeks they had 110,000 fan letters. The response has been phenomenal. And it's in its almost, well, I guess beginning its fourth year mm-hmm. now. Which has to tell you something, because people can remember, well, I Love a Mystery, for example. You remember the Temple of Vampires. Tell me what happened on Kojak last week. You can't
no,
do it.
You can't.
You
right.
cannot do it, because you're not there. Mm-hmm. You may have watched Kojak, and you might have enjoyed it. I don't. But that's a matter of personal preference, I guess. I love Mary Tyler Moore. I love MASH. But if you ask me what happened on last week's show, I'd have to think about it. I'll bet you I could remember it if they were on radio, because I was there. I had created the set, the costumes, the lighting, the furniture, the people, their reactions were all going on in the camera inside my mind. Only radio allows that.
Do you think that... you mentioned that High Brown is working on another
yeah.
phase of this. Do you think that this will spark even greater interest
I hope so.
In radio? As
there are very few High Browns around, is the only thing. Mm-hmm. Very few. High is a genius. And we're all very indebted to him, and we're terribly loyal to him, and he is to us. But we go in to do High's show. For example, at 9 o'clock in the morning is the call. So for the first 20 minutes, we sit around the table and congratulate each other on how we don't look a day older, and isn't it marvelous? How come the rest of the world is so rotten when we're so wonderful? And at about 20 after 9, High says, that's it now with the visiting. Let's go to work. And he starts the stopwatch. We read the script cold, never having seen it. The sound man's at the end of the table making his notes. We get up on our feet after that when High has made whatever cuts are necessary. We do the whole thing. We're out at 11:15, having done an hour show in no more than 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic.
That's almost the way it was in the heyday of radio when you were doing live shows. You
well,
would have
with the live ones, the 15-minute mm-hmm. ones, it seems to me that Big Sister, for example, was on at 1 o'clock, 1 to 1:15, and I think we were called at 11:30. That was a 15-minute show, but... Orson shows, and I, Inner Sanctum, I think it was on at 7:30 Or 8. We were called at 2:30. So you had a few hours then. But now, since everything is accelerated, mm-hmm. we do an hour show in 2 hours. That's wild. And I must say, in defense of all of the people connected with it, it goes without saying that the people are very good at what they do or they couldn't pull it off.
Well, I've read a quote by High Brown. Mm-hmm. He said that he uses the pros mm-hmm. on that because he doesn't have to fiddle around with an amateur.
Mm-hmm.
He knows that he can get the job done mm-hmm. in an economical amount of time.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is part of the whole thing.
Yes, it is.
But you people do a great job with it.
Well, I think most of us would do anything for him. I would. Mm-hmm. He's a great, great guy. See, that's what I mean, the loyalties that exist in radio. I've spoken now about Orson and High and Archola uh-huh. the same way. I feel that way in Carlton Morris. I'd do anything for Carlton Morris, anything in the world. I don't know how many people in the theater or in films I could say that about. But we're fierce in our loyalty to mm-hmm. to radio, which must mean, too, that it gave back to us a good deal, or we wouldn't feel this loyalty.
You worked an awful lot for Carlton E. Morris. Mm-hmm. You were on both One Man's Family mm-hmm. and I Love a
and Mystery.
Mystery,
yeah.
Now, on the One Man's Family, were you a part of the family?
Beth Holly.
Beth.
Who was Cliff's girlfriend.
Oh, I see.
Mm-hmm. She wasn't a terribly... My problem was, you see, that I would go... to do I Love a Mystery for a while in California, and then I'd get this itch about conquering in New York again. So I'd go back and try that conquering bit for a little while, and then I wouldn't conquer it, and then I'd call Carlton and say, "Oh, here I come again," and he'd put me back on the mystery. They were very good to me. They indulged me in all of my whims.
Well, I think they recognized a good talent, too.
Well, no, there's a lot of talent around. We have no shortage of talent. We do have shortage of opportunity. Oh, my heavens, the talent. I spend as much time as I can now on campuses. And there is a world of talent.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, very gifted people.
What are these people going to do?
I don't know.
You know, we love radio as much as you do.
Mm.
And there's not enough of it being produced today. I mean, God bless the CBS Mystery Theater.
Yes, indeed.
But still... How can someone who really feels that they have a flair for radio acting, how can they get in there?
How can they get started? I don't know. It's dismal. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely dismal, the whole prospect of it. Mm-hmm. I was artist in residence for a year, about 3 years ago, at the Catholic University of America in Washington. And I was in the graduate department with the students there. And I kept talking about radio, and I could read the scorn on the faces, you know. Oh, come on, radio. Well, I asked permission to see if I couldn't get them to tape Dylan Thomas's Under Milkwood. And the students were very loath to do it. A couple of them thought it might be interesting, but they didn't like the idea. So we recorded it as a radio show, and I played it back for them. And to a man or woman... They wanted to go in a group and jump off the Washington Monument and kill themselves. They had no idea how little they were conveying with their voices, uh-huh. how sloppy their diction was, how short a range they had, how little control they had over their breathing. So many things. So then they asked if they could really go to work on it. And we did. We worked on it for several weeks, and the result was marvelous. So I don't for 1 minute ever allow anybody to put radio down. With that cavalier attitude of, oh, come on, that was all right a generation ago. I always say to them, let's see if you can do it. And they find out that it's a lot more difficult than they think it is. A lot more.
You made it sound easy, though, the way you did it. You were swinging on a rope in the Temple of Vampires. Or you
well,
were
we were swinging back and forth in the studio. Great deal of physical activity going on. But terrible things would happen on the mystery... Honestly, Bart Yarborough, who played Doc, was an imp, a delightful imp, but maddening sometimes. And sometimes, right in the middle of a very dramatic speech, he would come and set fire to my script. He'd just light the bottom of the page and walk away and leave me there. And I'm trying to emote, and I'm trying to get the flame to go out in my bare hand. And he's over in the corner laughing. A lot of terrible things happened to us in studios, but they were funny.
Well, did Carlton Morse buy that? Did he go along with that?
Oh,
or
sure.
Wasn't he around then?
Oh, sure. Carlton was in the control room laughing. Uh-huh. He knew that
he
nothing.
Oh, he enjoyed it too?
Yes. Oh, yes. Carlton loved it. Just loved it. We had fun. That was the
uh-huh.
point.
Uh-huh.
And I remember a marvelous thing. On the Rudy Valley Seal Test Hour, in 1941, Christmas Eve, we did the Christmas Carol. And John Barrymore and Lionel Barrymore, in his wheelchair, were on it. And I played Tiny Tim. Because it was a radio show, it didn't matter. And I played the little boy. The only thing is, I was very, very pregnant. And we finished the show at about, I guess it was off the air at 8:30, and everybody said goodnight and Merry Christmas. And everybody went home for their Christmas Eve celebration. And I went home and went immediately to the hospital, and my son was born 4 hours after I was off the air. So the next morning, I couldn't resist it because it was a great opportunity, and I called everybody connected with the show and said, my son and I would like to wish you a Merry Christmas. And they all reacted in the way I wanted them to and said, what do you mean? You just left us. You were just on the air with us 8 hours ago or something. And I said, yeah, all just the same. My son and I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. So when I called Mr. Barrymore's house, he was asleep, and his Japanese houseboy took the message, and that afternoon a wire came to the Cedars of Lebanon Hospital to me, and it said, congratulations to you and the other wise man. Imagine his surprise when he found that the star he came to see was you, John Barrymore. And somehow that's a very typical radio story, that a woman very large with child, imminent with child indeed, could be playing Tiny Tim with John Barrymore and Lionel Barrymore, and the next morning deliver her son, and then have such a lovely thing happen to her that afternoon from one of the members of the cast. I don't mean that there aren't marvelous people in films and in the theater, but, and I guess I'm prejudicial because radio was my beginning, but I have great regard, great love, and enormous gratitude to radio.
How did you make the transition from radio to movies?
I've never felt there was any kind of transition to be made.
You just kept one with the other at the same time. Huh?
Walter Houston told me that early on, and I'm very grateful. Acting is acting is acting. It's merely a question of projection. If now I am sitting with you here, and I am trying to convey to you that it is terribly important for me to tell you that I love you, that's enough to convey it here, at this distance. If, however, I were standing medium distance from you across the room in a film studio, it demands a different kind of projection. It becomes terribly important for me to tell you that I love you. If, on the other hand, I am in a theater and there's a capacity audience of 1,200, 12,000 people, it becomes terribly important for me to tell you that I love you. But what's changed? Nothing. Projection? Whom are you trying to reach? What is involved in trying to reach that person? But what is the difference in the feeling? None. One is as intense as the other. It's an opening of a door. And you open it as far as is necessary to let the light in.
You are spellbinding.
No, I just talk a lot.
No, I love you.
Yeah, see, you can say it too.
You're marvelous. You are one of the, if not the first lady of radio, I think.
Oh. Well, you mean I started before anybody else?
No, I don't mean the first lady. I mean the first lady. Mercedes McCambridge, you're...
No, there were a great many marvelous actresses in radio. Oh, so many of them were my idols. You know, Aggie Moorhead, Ann Seymour, Elspeth Eric. Oh, there were so many. Some of them I hated. I really hated them.
Why did you hate them?
Oh, when they got the parts I wanted.
Oh. Did you ever lose a good part, a part that you thought would be good for you, and for some reason that you couldn't understand?
No. No, I don't think so. No. I was on... Irv Cups in it showed with Cornelia Otis Skinner today, who was plugging her book, Life with Lindsay and Krauss. And they fired me from a play after 9 days of rehearsal because they said I was pregnant with warmth, and it was a tough character there, you see? I wasn't able to be as tough on stage as they thought the character needed to be. In The Hasty Heart, I was coming across too warmly as the nurse and empathizing too much with the patients, so I was too warm, and they said no. So that was it. But I've been... Oh, my heavens, I've been lucky. Wow, I have been so lucky. Because the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, according to Shakespeare... The director of this play has all of the instincts of an actor. Magnificent instincts. And I watched him in rehearsal. And I went to him and said, Vernon, you're such a great actor. Why aren't you an actor? And he said, because I could never take the pain. An awful lot of... Gadge Kazan told me that. Yeah, Kazan told me that. In the beginning, he was an actor with the group theater. But he said he read a terrible notice about himself in Brooks Atkinson column, Atkinson's column, and said, that's it, I'll never take that. And Ted Bakel said it one night on a panel show, Theater Bakel, when everybody was being very high-flown about the qualities most needed to be a performer. And Ted said, I think it's very simple. It's the ability to hurt over a long period of time. This is an extremely rough way to go if you have any kind of a sensitivity of a feeling. You get hurt a lot.
Can you think of a particularly challenging role on radio that you met? A challenge that you met?
Oh, dear me. Some of them with Orson. Anything with Orson was. I think Tender is the Night, which Fletcher Markle did on Studio One, was one of the roughest ones. That was very hard for me. I was with Jim Daly, and I think he's brilliant, and I love doing it. Let me see. There was one that was on for, I think it was one of the mental health programs that I did called... I think it was called The Dark Room, Dark Corridor is what it was called. And that was very hard for me. But it was very good. And some months ago on CBS Mystery Playhouse, I did one written by a dear friend of mine, Elspeth Eric, about a woman who attempts suicide. Mm-hmm. And it was almost a monologue. Oh, many, many, many challenges on radio. Lots of them. Doing Macbeth on radio was very hard, doing Lady Macbeth. It's very hard in classics, you know, to on radio, because really, in theater, there's the majesty of the costumes and the glorious settings and the whole Shakespearean flair. And once again, in radio, you merely have the voice, so that when you see Lady Macbeth calling on the spirits to possess her in a well-lighted scene, on film or on stage, and with the long flowing gowns and the rather ghostly makeup, you've got a lot going for you. Whereas on radio, all it is you know, when she says, come to my woman's breasts and take my milk for God, murdering ministers. Very hard to sustain that with merely a voice going. But you work and you work and you work and you hope you get it across.
You do.
It's fun. Miss God Bless Radio.
Thank you very much, Mercedes McCambridge. We've got to come out and see you here at the
yes,
Drury Lane South.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.